Ready for the last case of the morning. It is Harris versus Marr 20-1002. Counsel for appellant, would you please make your appearance and proceed?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Michelle Horn, and I represent the appellant, Sergeant Marr. The district court here erred in denying Sergeant Marr qualified immunity. Plaintiffs have not carried their heavy two-part burden of showing both a constitutional violation and that the law was clearly established at the time of the incident. Failure to establish either of these two prongs is fatal to plaintiff's cause of action. According to the allegations in the complaint, after Mr. Harris was arrested, Sergeant Marr told the Aurora police officers not to enter his home until a warrant had been secured. They nonetheless entered after there was some internal confusion among them whether or not they were being asked to search the home. There is no allegation in the complaint that Sergeant Marr was present during the discussions among the Aurora officers, that he knew about the confusion among the Aurora officers, that he knew they had entered the home against his instructions, or that the Aurora officers ever told him they were going to enter the residence. Plaintiffs characterized Sergeant Marr's constitutional violation as the failure to clarify to the Aurora team that no warrant had issued. The allegations against each of the Denver officers in the complaint were practically identical. However, in denying qualified immunity to the granting qualified immunity to the other officers, but denying it to Sergeant Marr, the district court focused on the allegation that he allowed the officers to enter. This statement, however, is completely devoid of further factual enhancement in the complaint. There's no factual allegations exactly how he allowed the officers to enter.
I mean, what more could they have said? He was on the scene. There was confusion. They started to enter, and he allowed it to happen. He didn't do anything.
Your Honor, I propose that the term allowing the officers to enter is exactly the same in this context as if it were alleged that he failed to intervene. There is no factual support to how the allowance or the allowing happened. They could have argued that, yes, he was there. He heard the Aurora officers, had any of this been true, that he heard the Aurora officers first. He knew there was confusion, but he didn't act. Knowing there was confusion, he didn't act to clarify the confusion. That would have been an entirely different allegation. What is here? There's no allegations of the fact that he knew about the discussions among their war officers, or that they were intending to enter, or that they in fact had entered. There's simply nothing alleging Sergeant Marr's involvement in the entire transaction past the allegation that he told the Aurora officers not to enter.
What do you have as far as context from the complaint as far as where he was on the premises? I mean, it says he was on the scene, but that could arguably be anywhere.
I agree, Your Honor. There's nothing in the complaint saying he was anywhere close. It was on the scene. That could have been multiple blocks. And the presupposing that the search was indeed illegal. And we're not, as I said in my opening brief, this panel does not have to decide whether or not the underlying search was illegal or illegal. The plaintiffs have failed to establish the elements of a failure to intervene claim. And although the failure to intervene claim arose in the excessive force context, if it is adjusted to an illegal search context, they would have to show that Sergeant Marr witnessed or knew of an instance of an illegal search and had a realistic opportunity to intervene in the illegal search.
Do you accept the premise that the failure to intervene rubric applies in the Fourth Amendment search and seizure context as opposed to just in the excessive force context?
Your Honor, I believe there are significant problems with applying the test that grew up in the Fourth Amendment excessive force analysis to the illegal search analysis, because there are simply nuances in the search context that are not present in the excessive force context. It is not as obvious that an officer is engaging in an illegal search as it would be, for instance, if an officer was beating a suspect that was handcuffed and on the ground and obviously submissive. That's obviously an example of excessive force. But if you drive up to a scene and see an officer going into a home, it is not obvious whether or not that officer, first of all, has a warrant, or if there's an applicable exception to the Fourth Amendment that would allow that officer to enter without a warrant. It is simply different in the degree of the obviousness of the constitutional violation that makes the test for excessive force and failure to intervene difficult to apply in a illegal search context.
Go ahead, Judge.
Are you aware of any published decision from any circuit that has applied the duty to intervene to a search in the search and seizure context?
Your Honor, I am not personally aware of any.
Okay.
And so I take it your premise is, I take it from your argument that you don't believe that Vondrick, the general language about failure to intervene in Vondrick, clearly established the law as it relates to the applicability of that failure to intervene rubric for purposes of search and seizure.
Correct, Your Honor. I agree that the broadly written language does encompass this, the facts of this case. However, for clearly established purposes, you have to have the broad language. You have to have particularity of facts. And the fact that Vondrack itself was a handcuffing excessive force case makes it clearly it's not particularized to this case at all. Not only does it deal with a different Fourth Amendment violation.
It does, and I need to stop you because I want to make sure I understood what you said. Are you saying that you do accept the premise that Vondrack applies failure to intervene in the Fourth Amendment search and seizure context?
No, Your Honor, I do not, because it is not particularized enough to the illegal search context. And as I stated before, there are nuances in the illegal search context that just simply are not present for in the excessive force context.
Okay, I just wanted to be clear. Okay, so that you're not accepting that premise. There are two cases that were cited, unpublished cases, by the appellant. I take it you do not believe those clearly establish the law on this issue, that failure to intervene applies in the search and seizure context.
Correct, Your Honor. For the first basic premise is that unpublished cases, this court has held several times, unpublished cases cannot clearly establish the law. And second of all, both of those cases are distinguishable. One of the cases, the court did not find a failure to intervene at all. They found because there was no underlying constitutional violation that it could not be a failure to intervene. The second of all, it was an illegal seizure in all the horse cases. The facts in that those cases are simply too distinguishable from the facts in this cases to apply the failure to intervene law to an illegal search context. Your Honor, there is no allegations in the complaint that Sergeant Marr, first of all, witnessed or knew about the illegal search conducted by the Aurora officers. As I said before, there's no allegations that he was there, that he overheard it, that he was informed of it. It simply is no allegations whatsoever that he knew about the constitutional violation. Second of all, being that there's no allegations that he was there or knew about it, there could not be any realistic obligation that he had a realistic opportunity to intervene to stop the illegal search. If he's not there, if he doesn't know about it, if they didn't tell him about it, there simply cannot be a reasonable opportunity for him to have intervened in the illegal search by the Aurora officers.
So I don't want to beat the horse too much, but they say that in their complaint, they allege that he was on the scene and that he didn't prevent them, didn't intervene, or didn't clarify his order to keep them from going in. What would you say they had to allege to be sufficient? What more did they have to do in your mind?
Your Honor, I think this case has just so many errors. I don't know that it could be cured. I don't I don't think that the failure to intervene test as it exists now in the 10th Circuit is workable for an illegal search. That's my first argument. Second of all, there has to be some connection between Sergeant Marr and the alleged constitutional violation.
So what if they said that Sergeant Marr was on the scene standing by the door?
Your Honor, if he's standing by the door and he tells them not to enter, he is intervening to stop the search. Whether he's successful or not, that's something else, but that is an intervention, even if he is by the door.
Okay, then they leave. So, I mean, the facts of this case are that he told them, don't go in there, we're getting a warrant, right?
Yes.
And then they sort of disappear, the Aurora PD officers disappear, and then they come back acting all confused. And put that intervening fact in there, and they came back all confused, and he noticed that, and he was standing by the door, and he didn't stop them from going in.
Yeah, and I think then you get a closer case. I'm not saying that is a failure to intervene, because again, you have my primary argument, this doesn't cleanly apply to searches, but then you get a closer case. But those are facts not in the complaint as we have them right now.
Right.
And unless there are further questions right now, I'd like to save my remaining time for rebuttal.
That's fine, counsel.
May it please the court. Helen O, on behalf of plaintiffs appellees Marquise Harris, Artesia Cabral, and their minor child, NC. First, plaintiffs plausibly allege that defendant Marr failed to intervene. Defendants here are trying to impose a heightened standard, and this court knows that heightened pleading is not required in 1983 actions. And moreover, the allegations here specifically—
Are they asking for a heightened standard, or are they asking for facts that are alleged that would fit the bill?
The facts here, as we have them, do fit the bill, in our opinion. And so what...
Well, okay, what we've got is that he told them not to enter. We don't know where he was. We don't know how big the scene was. We know there was an upstairs, at least. We don't know if he was upstairs or if he was out in a squad car. What heightened standard is there other than facts?
So here the facts demonstrate, and the facts allege that Sergeant Marr was on scene outside plaintiff's apartment.
What does that mean, on scene? Does that mean he was at the top of the stairs, he was guarding the door, he was down at the bottom of the stairs prohibiting people from coming up? What does that mean?
It isn't specified what that means exactly, but this court in Casey versus City Federal Heights, in Fogarty versus Gallegos, and in Vondrak versus City of Las Cruces have repeatedly looked to allegations that state that the defendant was alleged to have been on scene, that they were present.
Those cases that you're citing were all decided prior to Twombly v. Iqbal, weren't they?
Yes, those were in 2008.
And they were all summary judgment cases, right?
Yes, they were summary judgment
cases. That's a distinction with a difference. I mean, you're talking about a complaint. And to that point, isn't the interpretation of a complaint a legal question?
Yes, it is.
Okay, well then we do that de novo, which means that however the district court chose to interpret paragraph 53, we're not bound by that, right?
Right.
Okay, then. Well, this ambiguous word allow could mean anything. And to go back to Judge Carson's question earlier, what facts could have been there that aren't there? If you look at your Reed versus Wren, you have the individuals who are held responsible. They were right there. They heard it happen and they didn't intervene. You don't have facts here that says he was right at the door at that moment. He could have stopped them and he didn't do it. All you have is allowed. And what does that get you?
So what we have here in paragraph 18, we allege that Sergeant Marr was on scene, that he had just received, on scene actually outside plaintiff's apartment, that he had just received word from DPD Sergeant Engelbert that they were obtaining a search warrant, and that Denver Sergeant Marr then told the APD officers not to enter the apartment until a search warrant could be obtained. When these allegations are taken as a whole, so subsequently in paragraphs 22 and 23, we also see there that despite the fact that several DPD officers were on the scene, there was confusion among the APD officers on the scene. After that, there are allegations that the APD officers knocked on the door. They walked up and down the stairs, verbalizing.
Indeed, but it doesn't say that Sergeant Marr was there. In fact, the only affirmative act you have of Sergeant Marr was one where he says, don't do it. I mean, and beyond that, it says allowed. In fact, why isn't this case more like the unpublished case Anderson that you cite, in which the officers actually turned around, I mean, ran around to try to stop the officer them from entering the house? Well, he said, don't enter. Why, and the result there was a grant of qualified immunity. Why shouldn't that be the same outcome here?
The case in Anderson is distinguishable. Sergeant Marr, here what happened is that Sergeant Marr was preemptively giving an instruction to the APD officers not to enter because a search warrant was being obtained. The duty to intervene arises. It's implicated once the officer has knowledge that a constitutional violation has occurred or is about to occur. And so during these moments, there are several allegations in here that detail that Sergeant Marr was just on scene, that he had just given that instruction to the APD officers also on scene, and that those officers then subsequently expressed confusion, that they were walking up and down the stairs.
Is there any allegation that Sergeant Marr was aware of this confusion, that he was anywhere near those stairs, that he had any knowledge of any of that?
Not exactly. The allegation would be that he was on scene. And you take it in the light most favorably to plaintiffs. Plaintiffs need to allege that the claim is plausible. And here we have a lot of different allegations here. I know that these failure to intervene cases are pre-Iqbal, but in those cases, this court analyzed failure to intervene, and the analysis was very straightforward. The court looked to the defendant's proximity at the time of the violation.
What is that here, though? So we're going to take you as true. We're going to look to his proximity. I mean, all we have is he was on the scene, which could mean he was down at the curb. It could mean he was in the back. We don't know where he was.
We also have here that Denver Police Department officers were in charge of the operation. One of the factors that the court sometimes looks to is the level of authority the officer has over the other officers. And clearly here we have that Denver Sergeant Marr gave the instruction to the APD officers not to enter. This was a similar fact that the court looked at in Casey with the officer on scene. He had knowledge of the circumstances. They were conducting surveillance over the plaintiff's house. And so they had known that no exigent circumstances were present, that no warrant had been issued, and that no consent was given. And so taken as a whole, these allegations demonstrate that Sergeant Marr was on scene, that he had knowledge of the constitutional violation, and that he had numerous.
And where do you get the knowledge from? There has to be realistic opportunity to intervene and knowledge of. And knowledge of, there's no allegation that he was at the steps. There's no allegation he was aware of the confusion. There's no allegation that he was at the door and said and could have stopped them. There was none of that. All you have is at the scene, and you know, if one's looking at the district court opinion, Gross, Trujillo, and Black, they were granted summary judgment, and you have the exact same situation with them. They were at the scene, and so which shows you at least the district court may have been internally inconsistent in deciding how to give summary judgment. I mean, not summary judgment. I'm sorry, dismissal on the complaint. What do you have that will establish knowledge that this was about to happen, therefore realistic opportunity to intervene? What's right. The best you got?
It's really all these allegations between in paragraphs between 15 to 31.
Well, 15 to, well, I think the 53 is the, it seems to me, is the best you got. And the one the district court relied on, allowed, and allowed is pretty ambiguous.
This court actually in Fogarty versus Gallegos looked to a very similar allegation that an officer who failed to intervene stood by as he watched the force being used, and that all the defendant officers had used or permitted that force. And that was sufficient.
That's a little different. He stood by and watched. I mean, that indicates that awareness that you don't, and you don't have that here.
Here, the allegations don't have to explicitly state what exactly the opportunities were or the knowledge. This court may make reasonable inferences based on the allegations that there was knowledge and opportunities to intervene. Here, Defendant Sergeant Marr was in direct communication with another Denver sergeant in charge of the operation that no search warrant had been obtained. And so
based upon that, he told them, don't go in. Right. Okay. And you accept the premise, I take it, from Paul's versus Thomas, for example, that this has to be individual supervisory liability, right? There's no collective liability here. It has to be him individually in a position to do something.
Right.
Okay. Well, the fact that that DPD was aware of the confusion, the fact that, you know, that there was confusion, the fact that somebody violated his constitutional rights does nothing as it relates to Sergeant Marr unless you can tag him with something. And so if you say collectively all those paragraphs do it, then all I would say is give me the best language out of one or two paragraphs that I can hang a hook on. And if all you got is allowed, then that's a problem.
This court can look to the totality of the allegations and based on that, make reasonable inferences. And so when Sergeant Marr was alleged to have been on scene outside plaintiff's apartment, that he then gave an instruction to APD officers also on scene not to go in, that those same APD officers on scene then shortly thereafter expressed confusion, went up and down.
To whom did they express confusion?
Vocally out loud to one another.
Well, that doesn't say they expressed it to Sergeant Marr, does it?
It doesn't, but the reasonable inference is that Sergeant Marr was still on scene.
Aurora officers who were expressing confusion at the top of the stairs?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Wasn't it the Aurora officers expressing confusion at the top of the stairs?
Yes. Yes, it was. They walked back down the stairs. And so, right. And in allegation 53, we have that, despite Sergeant Marr telling the defendant, the Aurora defendants, to hold off, he nonetheless did allow them to enter.
We've been focusing on the constitutional violation. Let me focus on clearly established law for a second. As best I can discern, all you have, and tell me if I'm wrong, is the general statement from Vondrake and then these two unpublished decisions, one of which you tried to distinguish from this case. Why does that give you clearly established law under our precedent for this search and seizure context as it relates to the failure to intervene rubric? I mean, why is it clearly established that the failure to intervene rubric applies at all? And then if it does apply, why are the facts close enough to this case that you can make it work?
You're absolutely right that there isn't precedent that includes a failure to intervene claim specifically in the context of an unlawful entry and search. However, general constitutional rules can apply with obvious clarity even in novel factual circumstances, and in a case like failure to intervene, a broad construction of that it applies to any constitutional violation, it makes sense. It's really the only way it comports with the fundamental purpose of failure to intervene claims. And so what we have here, when the underlying violation is clearly established, just like this court analyzed in Vondrak, it actually separately analyzed whether the underlying excessive force was clearly established, and that whether the defendant then met the two elements of failing to intervene.
Well, the question is whether it is clearly established. And if let's assume for the moment that the rubric does apply, and that could be an open question itself. But let's assume failure to intervene as a doctrine applies in this search and seizure context. Then the question becomes whether there's a case that's close enough that fits it. And if I understood your brief, what you're saying is we don't need a close case because this was an obvious violation of the law. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, it's an obvious violation. And moreover, looking at qualified immunity jurisprudence, the Supreme Court has reiterated that specificity in previous case law is especially important in excessive force cases, particularly because those cases involve split-second decision-making, tense circumstances that are rapidly evolving, sometimes danger. And here what we have is none of that. And in fact, it's arguable that these unlawful search claims provide less subjectivity and clearer rules because there are very clear delineated exceptions to the warrant requirement. And well,
assuming this doctrine applies here, wouldn't you think that Sergeant Marr would need some Clay case that at least has roughly analogous facts so that he would know that after he told them not to go in, that there could be anything he could do that would subject him to liability? I mean, he's not supposed to tackle them. And so what would he know based upon general principles that he violated the law?
Right. The Seventh Circuit has restated this broad principle that any person given the badge of authority can't ignore the duty imposed by his office to fail to stop other officers from punishing a third person in their presence. And any reasonable officer would know this. This not only does Vondrak clearly establish that this applies to any constitutional violation, but when the underlying violation itself, the unlawful entry and search, when the circumstances are clear that violated the Constitution and that Defendant Marr both had knowledge of the constitutional violation and opportunities to intervene, that suffices as providing clear notice that Sergeant Marr knew that his conduct would be unconstitutional.
Okay, you're out of time. Thank you, counsel, for your argument. I think there's a little bit of rebuttal. Yeah, quite a bit of rebuttal left time. So please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ms. O mentioned several times the court's holding in Fogarty versus Gallegos, which was a failure to intervene in an excessive force case. In that case, the court, even though that was pre-Iqbal, the court, and it was a summary judgment motion, so it's a little different, the court examined the conduct of several officers. Of particular interest for this case is their handling of the allegations against Sergeant Keith. Sergeant Keith was a sergeant. He was a supervisory officer. He was on the scene. But the court failed to find that he failed to intervene because he had there was no affirmative link between his being on the scene and the constitutional violations. I believe that is the exact thing we're dealing with here. It's alleged that Sergeant Marr was a sergeant, he was a supervisor, he was on the scene, but there's no affirmative link between him and the actual constitutional violation other than his words to the officers not to enter. And unless there are questions from the panel, I am going to end my argument here.
Thank you.
Giving up time is always a good thing. Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted.